Welcome back for another deep dive. This time, we're taking a look at game programming patterns. You know, those clever techniques that make our favorite games tick.
It's kind of like peeking under the hood of a super fast car, seeing all those intricate engine parts working together to create such a smooth, exhilarating ride.
And I bet you'd love to build those engines yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Level up your programming skills, especially for game dev, and really stand out as a programmer.
You're in it for the long haul. Leading teams, building games with real staying power. And that source you gave me, game programming patterns. It's the perfect roadmap for that journey.
Okay, so let's get into these patterns. What are they exactly? Why are they so important for someone who wants to become a top game developer?
Well, think of game programming patterns as proven solutions to problems that pop up all the time, like having an architect's blueprints for building solid game systems that really work.
So instead of starting from scratch each time, you're using these proven designs.
Exactly. And these patterns, they help you write cleaner, more efficient code. And that's crucial, especially when working on those huge, complicated games. Makes it easier to understand and maintain, too, especially if you're working on a team.
Which is super important if you're leading a team or building a project that you want to last.
Absolutely. Knowing these patterns shows you're a seasoned pro. You get how to code effectively for game dev.
Okay, I'm starting to see why these patterns are so important. So let's dive into some specific ones. What's the command pattern all about?
Imagine a strategy game, right? You're moving units all over the map. The command pattern, it takes each action like move this unit over here and packages it into its own object.
Oh, so instead of this massive code block for every action, each command is nicely organized.
Yeah, that's it. Makes the code super flexible, add new commands, tweak the old ones, even put in features like undo without having to rewrite everything.
Wow, it's like those modular building blocks. So what about the flyweight pattern? That sounds interesting.
Flyweight is all about efficiency, especially when you have tons of similar objects. Like, picture a forest in a game with hundreds and hundreds of trees.
Yeah, those incredibly detailed landscapes you just get lost in.
Right. Now, rendering each tree individually, that would be a nightmare for your computer. But with the flyweight pattern, you can share the common stuff, the tree's model, the textures across all of them.
So you're not storing the same information a zillion times, you're reusing a blueprint.
Exactly. You drastically cut down on memory usage and processing power. That's how we get those awesome environments without killing performance.
That's brilliant. Now the observer pattern, I hear that one mentioned a lot. What's it all about in game dev?
Think of it like an in-game communication system. Say your character takes damage. Instead of directly telling every single system the health bar, the sound effects, you use the observer pattern.
So it's like broadcasting a message internally.
Exactly. The systems that need to know, like the health bar or a damage sound effect, they subscribe to the event. And when it happens, bam, they get notified.
That's interesting. So each part is kind of independent, reacting to events without being directly connected to each other.
Right. Keeps the code clean and organized, especially as things get more complex.
Makes sense. Now, the prototype pattern. Do a lot of developers use that one?
The prototype pattern is useful sometimes, but these days in game dev, we tend to favor patterns like component and type object, especially when working with all the different kinds of game entities.
So prototype is less common nowadays.
Well, it's not bad or anything. It's just that some other patterns offer more flexibility and efficiency for the challenges we face in modern game development.
Gotcha. So singleton. That one seems to come up pretty often. What's the idea there?
The singleton pattern makes sure you have only one instance of a specific class. Like, think about your game's audio manager. You don't want multiple ones messing things up, so you just have one to streamline everything.
Like a central control panel for certain functions.
That's the idea. It's powerful, though, so use it carefully. Too much singleton can lead to code that's really hard to maintain and change later on.
Got it. Singleton in moderation. So what about the state pattern? Where does that one come in?
Think about characters in a game. How they smoothly switch between actions, standing, walking, jumping, attacking. The state pattern handles these changes based on what the character is doing at that moment.
So instead of a jumbled mess of if-else statements, each state has its own logic.
Exactly. Makes the code way cleaner and easier to understand, especially when you've got complex characters doing all sorts of things.
I'm starting to see how all these patterns bring structure and clarity to the code.
Yeah, and that structure, it's even more important when working on bigger projects or with a whole team, like a shared language that everyone understands.
Yeah, like everyone on a team knowing their role and how to work together smoothly.
Right. Which brings us to another important pattern, double buffering. Have you ever seen screen tearing in a game, where the visuals kind of split?
Ugh, yeah, it's super distracting.
Well, double buffering stops that. It draws the next frame off screen in a back buffer and then quickly swaps it with what you're currently seeing.
Like having two stages, one for the current show and one for the next, and switching between them seamlessly.
You got it. That's how we get those smooth visuals without the annoying tearing effects.
That's clever. Probably why we don't even notice it happening in the background. Speaking of behind the scenes, what about the game loop? What exactly is that?
Think of the game loop as the heart of the game. It's that constant cycle that updates everything, processes player input, and renders what you see on screen.
Like a conductor leading an orchestra, keeping everything in sync.
Perfect analogy. A stable and efficient game loop is so crucial for a smooth, responsive game.
Ah, so that's why some games feel so fluid and responsive and others feel clunky.
Yep, it all comes down to how well the game loop is designed and put together.
All right, that makes a lot of sense. So the game loop's ticking away. What other patterns do we need to consider?
Let's chat about the update method pattern. This one helps organize how game objects behave within that game loop.
So each object has its own way of updating its state and logic.
Right. It's like each object has its own update method, and the game loop calls it every frame. That method handles the object's logic, movement, all the updates it needs.
So it's like each object has its own little brain figuring out what to do each frame based on what's going on in the game.
Exactly. This keeps the code nice and tidy and makes it easier to handle all the interactions between those different objects.
I'm starting to see how all these patterns work together to build a really well-structured game.
And that structure is what lets you build games that are not only fun, but also robust and scalable.
So it's not just about making the game work, but making it work well. And in a way that you can easily expand and improve over time.
Absolutely. And that's a big part of why understanding these patterns is so important, especially if you dream of working on big projects or leading a team.
Yeah, I see the bigger picture now. So, what's next in our pattern tour?
Let's talk about the component pattern. This one breaks down those complex game objects into smaller, more manageable chunks.
So instead of one giant class for a character, you have separate components for things like physics, rendering, AI.
That's it. This modular approach, it makes the code way easier to understand, maintain, and tweak. It also lets different programmers specialize, focusing on different components.
Ah, that's smart. Like having a team of experts working on different parts of a car instead of one person trying to build the whole thing.
Exactly. The component pattern encourages collaboration and lets teams build those complex game objects more efficiently.
I'm feeling like a game development architect now. What other patterns should we have in our toolbox?
Let's talk about the event queue pattern. This one helps you manage all those events in a game: player actions, enemies dying, changes in the game state, and so on.
So it's like a central messaging system where different parts of the game can talk to each other.
Exactly. Instead of directly calling methods, you just add events to a queue. Those events can be processed later, which separates the sender and receiver.
So it's like sending a letter instead of calling someone. You don't need an immediate response. You handle the message when you can.
Great analogy. The event queue pattern gives you more flexibility and allows for that asynchronous communication between different parts of the game.
That's a clever way to keep the game running smoothly. So what about the service locator pattern? What kind of services are we talking about?
Think of services as common game functions like audio, logging, networking. The service locator pattern provides a single place to get to these services without creating tight connections in the code.
So instead of hard coding everything, you're using the service locator like a directory.
Precisely. This makes the code more adaptable, and you can easily swap or modify services without breaking other parts of the game.
Okay, that makes sense. It's like a central hub for all the important tools in your game. Wow, we've covered a lot of ground. I'm ready to learn more.
Let's take a break for now. We'll get into some more patterns a little later. Yeah, that was a good overview of some of those core patterns. Starting to see how they can really level up your game dev skills, huh?
Yeah, I'm getting a much better grasp on how they fit into the bigger picture of building games that are, well-structured, easy to maintain.
And don't forget, mastering these patterns, it's more than just writing code. It's understanding how to design systems that are robust, efficient. And that's where experience on big projects really comes in handy.
So learning from developers who've been there, done that, can make a big difference.
Absolutely. Having a mentor, someone who's navigated those tricky waters of large game projects, they can accelerate your learning, help you avoid those common pitfalls. Those insights, you'll find them in a textbook.
I'm seeing the value in that mentorship more and more. Okay, so let's keep going with our pattern exploration. What about data locality? That one sounds interesting.
Ugh, data locality. It's all about performance, squeezing out every bit of speed. You see, modern CPUs, they have this thing called a cache. It's like a little bit of super fast memory that stores data you use a lot.
So like having your most used tools right there within reach.
Exactly. And with the data locality pattern, you arrange your data in memory so that related stuff is all grouped together.
So the CPU can quickly grab everything it needs without having to search everywhere.
You got it. It can speed up processing like crazy, which means smoother gameplay, better performance overall.
So clever. Now, the dirty flag pattern, what's that one all about? Sounds a little mysterious.
It's actually pretty neat. Imagine a complex game object, like a spaceship with lots of moving parts. Say only one small part changes, like a turret rotating.
We wouldn't want to update the whole spaceship's data just for that,
right? So the dirty flag pattern uses a flag to mark which parts have actually changed. When it's time to update, only those dirty parts get processed. Saves a ton of calculations.
Oh, so it's like raising a flag to signal that something needs attention.
Exactly. Especially useful when you're dealing with complicated objects and those huge game worlds.
Okay, starting to see a theme here. These patterns are all about working smarter, not harder. What about the object pool pattern? How does that one work?
Okay, picture a game with tons of projectiles flying around, like bullets, missiles. Creating and destroying those all the time puts a lot of stress on the system.
So instead of constantly creating and destroying, you have this pool of pre-made objects.
That's it. The object pool pattern pre-allocates a bunch of objects and then just reuses them as needed. When you don't need one anymore, it goes back to the pool, not destroyed.
Like a recycling bin for game objects.
Aha, I love it. That reduces all the overhead of allocating and deallocating memory, making the game run smoother and preventing those annoying little hiccups.
These patterns are all so efficient. Okay, what about spatial partition? That one sounds like it might be a bit more on the complex side.
It can be, yeah, but the idea itself is pretty straightforward. Imagine a huge game world with thousands and thousands of objects, checking for collisions between all of them. Super inefficient.
Like trying to find a needle in a haystack. But the haystack is the whole game world.
Exactly. So what spatial partition does, it divides that world into smaller chunks, like regions or grids. That way, you only need to check for collisions between objects in the same area.
Oh, so it's like organizing that haystack into smaller piles. Much easier to find the needle.
You got it. It drastically cuts down on the number of collision checks, which is a huge performance boost, especially in games with large dynamic worlds.
Clever.
Yeah.
Now bytecode. That one sounds pretty intense.
Bytecode is basically creating a virtual machine inside your game that runs instructions written in a compact format.
Yeah.
It's definitely more advanced, but really powerful.
So like a mini computer inside your game running his own set of instructions.
Exactly. This lets you take a more data-driven approach to game logic. Easier to create mods, add scripting, even build whole new gameplay systems without recompiling the entire game.
That's incredible. I imagine it requires a pretty deep understanding of both programming and game design, though.
It does, but the rewards are definitely worth it. Opens up a ton of flexibility and creative potential.
Okay, bytecode's going on my list of things to learn more about. What about subclass sandbox? That one sounds a bit more approachable.
Subclass sandbox is all about giving developers a safe space to extend the game's behavior without breaking everything. Really useful when working with a team or allowing for mods.
So it's like giving them a designated area to experiment without messing up the core game.
Precisely. Let's say you're building a system for character abilities, special powers, right? Instead of giving developers access to all the core code, you give them the sandbox with limited functionality they can build on.
So they can create those new abilities within the sandbox, but they can't accidentally break other parts of the game.
Exactly. Keeps things stable, prevents those accidental bugs. It also makes the code more modular and easier to manage when you have lots of developers working on it.
Okay, those guardrails make a lot of sense. Prevents those whoops, I broke the game moments.
Exactly. More creative freedom while still keeping the core system safe.
I'm seeing how these patterns really help developers build complex and innovative games, all while keeping the code manageable. So what about the type object pattern? What's that one all about?
Imagine you're designing a game with a huge variety of characters, each with its own unique set of stats, abilities, and behaviors.
Like a classic RPG, with warriors, mages, rogues, all sorts of fantasy creatures.
Exactly. Instead of creating this rigid class structure for each character type, The type object pattern gives you a more flexible way to define and manage all those different kinds of objects.
So it's like having a template or blueprint that you can customize for each character.
You got it. This gives you way more flexibility and makes it easier to add new character types or variations without having to change the core game code. You can even define those types in external files or databases.
Wow, that's really powerful. Opens up so many possibilities for creating those diverse and dynamic game worlds.
And it keeps the code clean and manageable even as you add more and more character types.
I'm starting to understand how these patterns can really change the way we approach game development. It's not just about writing code, it's about designing systems that are elegant and efficient.
Absolutely. And remember, this journey of learning and applying these patterns, it's ongoing. The more you explore, the better you'll become as a developer.
That's encouraging. So, any tips for someone who really wants to master these patterns?
Well, the Game Programming Patterns book is a fantastic resource. And, you know, explore online communities, check out the code of open source games. There's a wealth of information out there.
And of course, finding a mentor who can offer guidance and share their experience, that's invaluable.
Couldn't agree more. Having someone who can answer your questions, give you feedback, offer real-world insights, it can really speed up your learning, especially if they have experience working on large game projects where those solid principles are absolutely key.
Right, having that experienced guide to navigate the world of game development.
Makes all the difference. Okay, let's look at a couple more patterns and then we can wrap things up.
Yeah, it's like we're starting to see how it all fits together. All these patterns, they're like the foundation of great game development.
It's like a symphony, really. Each instrument playing its part to create this amazing whole. And you know those solid principles we talked about earlier? They're like the musical theory behind it all, guiding the composition.
So solid is like the sheet music, and these patterns are the notes and melodies.
Love that analogy. Just like a composer uses music theory to create these beautiful, complex pieces, a skilled game dev uses solid and design patterns to build those robust, elegant game systems.
I'm starting to get a real appreciation for the art of writing well-structured code.
And that artistry, it becomes even more important when you're leading a team working on a project with long-term goals. That's where having a mentor who's been there can be such a game changer.
Right, like having someone to guide you through those complex harmonies, make sure your code doesn't fall apart.
Exactly. That kind of wisdom and insight you just can't get from a book.
Okay, so let's dive back into those patterns. What about service locator? How does that one work?
So the service locator pattern, it gives you a central place to access those common game services. Things like audio, logging, networking.
So instead of having all of those connections hard-coded throughout your code, you use the service locator like a directory.
Exactly. Makes the code much more flexible, modular. You can swap out those services, tweak them without messing up other parts of the game.
Got it. It's like a central hub for all the essential tools in your game.
That's a good way to think about it. And it helps keep your code clean, reduces dependencies between modules.
Makes sense. So what's next?
Let's talk about data locality. This one is all about performance optimization, making sure your game runs as fast as possible.
Okay, so it's about arranging data in a way that the CPU can easily access it.
Right. Modern CPUs have this thing called a cache. It's like a small, really fast memory bank that stores frequently used data. With data locality, you want to organize your data so that all those related pieces are stored close together.
So the CPU can grab what it needs in one go, no need to search all over memory.
Exactly. And that can lead to a big speed boost, smoother gameplay, better overall experience.
That's pretty neat. Okay, what about Dirty Flag? The name sounds kind of, I don't know, messy.
Don't worry, it's actually pretty clever. Imagine you've got a complex game object, like a character with lots of attributes. Stats, equipment, status effects.
Yeah, like those RPG characters with tons of variables.
Right. Now, if only a few of those attributes change, you don't want to waste time updating everything. So the Dirty Flag pattern uses a flag to mark which attributes have been modified.
Like putting a sticky note on a file that needs attention.
Perfect. You only process those dirty attributes, no wasted calculations, better efficiency all around.
Okay, that's a smart way to handle updates. What about the object pool pattern?
So imagine a game where you're creating and destroying tons of objects constantly. Bullets in a shooter, particles in an explosion, things like that.
Yeah, those effects can get pretty crazy.
Right, and all that creating and destroying can really put a strain on the system. So the object pool pattern, you pre-allocate a bunch of objects and then reuse them as needed.
So instead of creating a new bullet every time you fire, you grab one from the pool, use it, then send it back when you're done.
That's the idea. reduces the overhead of constantly allocating and deallocating memory, which makes the game run smoother, prevents those little stutters and lags.
I'm really starting to see how these patterns are all about optimization, efficiency.
They are. And now let's talk about spatial partition. This one can get a bit more complex, but the idea is pretty intuitive.
Bring it on.
All right, so picture a massive game world, thousands of objects all over the place. Checking for collisions or interactions between every single one would be a nightmare.
Yeah, talk about inefficient.
Right. So spatial partition divides that world into smaller sections, like regions or grids.
So it's like dividing a big city into neighborhoods, making it easier to keep track of everything.
Exactly. Now you only need to check for collisions or interactions between objects that are in the same area. Cuts down on those calculations big time.
Smart. That's a great way to manage all that complexity. All right, so what about bytecode? That one sounds pretty hardcore.
It is a bit more advanced, yeah. Basically, you're creating a virtual machine inside your game that runs instructions in a compact format, often used for scripting, modding, creating those dynamic gameplay systems.
So it's like a mini computer within your game running its own separate program.
You got it. And this lets you take a more data-driven approach, which makes the game much more flexible. You can change game logic without having to recompile everything, great for modding and prototyping.
That's really powerful. But I bet it takes a solid understanding of low-level programming, those virtual machine concepts.
It does, yeah, but the potential is huge. Opens up a whole new world of possibilities for creating dynamic, ever-evolving game experiences.
Bytecode is definitely going on my to-learn list. So what about subclass sandbox? That one sounds interesting too.
Subclass Sandbox is all about giving developers a safe and controlled way to extend the game without breaking everything. Really helpful for teams and for allowing mods.
So, like giving developers a special area where they can experiment without messing up the core game.
Exactly. Imagine you're building a game with a complex combat system, and you want to let people create mods that add new weapons or abilities.
Yeah, those mods can really change up a game.
Right. But instead of giving them direct access to all the core combat code, you provide this subclass sandbox with a limited set of functions they can use.
So they can build those new weapons and abilities, but they can't accidentally break the core combat system.
Precisely. It keeps things stable, helps prevent bugs and conflicts, and it makes the code more modular, easier to manage when you have lots of people working on it.
Smart. Like putting those safety rails in place, making sure the core game stays solid.
That's a great way to put it. And it lets everyone be more creative and collaborative.
Okay, now last but not least, type object. What's that one all about?
Imagine designing a game with tons of different characters, each with their own unique traits, abilities, and behaviors.
Like, your classic RPG full of warriors, wizards, rogues.
Exactly. Instead of creating a rigid class structure for each type, the type object pattern takes a more flexible, data-driven approach.
Oh, so it's like having a template that you can customize for each character.
You got it. You can define those character types in external files, databases, whatever. Makes it really easy to create variations, add new types, even balance the game, all without messing with the core code.
Wow, that's incredible. You could create such diverse and dynamic game worlds with that.
You could. And it keeps the code clean and manageable, even as you add more and more character types.
We've covered so much ground today. I feel like I have a much better understanding of how games are made now.
That's great to hear. And remember, this is really just the start of your journey into game programming patterns. The more you learn and explore, the more you'll see how powerful and elegant they can be.
I'm definitely inspired to keep learning and experimenting. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us today.
It's been my pleasure. And hey, if you ever have any questions or want to dig deeper into any of these patterns, don't hesitate to reach out.
Thanks again for joining us on this deep dive into game programming patterns. Until next time, keep coding, keep creating, and keep playing.